Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. In this episode, I got the chance to speak with Brandon from the New Money YouTube channel. Now, Brandon uploaded his first video to YouTube back in early 2017, and he's grown that channel to the point where he was able to transition from being a full-time physiotherapist based in Canberra through to being a full-time YouTube creator. So in this episode, we talk through that journey for Brandon as well as his investing strategy. Both of us are fairly heavily influenced by Warren Buffett, Phil Town, Charlie Munger, Monish Prabhai, and we're both sort of value investors. So with all that said, let's get straight into the episode, and I hope you enjoy. Great. All right. Thanks for joining me, Brandon. I've got a long list of questions to ask you. I'm looking forward to this conversation. But yeah. I think before we dive into that at all, I need to ask you, what is it like to own a Tesla?
It's good. First of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. I appreciate you having me on. But I've got my Tesla. I can see it from where I'm sitting right here. It's good. It's good, man. Like, you know, I'm just like a huge fan of, you know, Elon Musk and of the company, and just love what they're doing. So it's always been a dream of mine to actually get one. And the story is that, you know, I think it was October last year in Australia, they dropped their pricing on all models by about $8,000. Plus they added a whole bunch more features. So I was just like, nah, this is it. This is it. I got to go for it. So I actually ordered it at 1:30 in the morning. I was lying in bed. My girlfriend was asleep and I was just like buzzing because I just hit order. And then I was just like, I need to talk to someone. And I just had no one to talk to. So it took me a little while to get to sleep that night, but I absolutely love it. It's a great car. It's good fun to drive. We'll have to get you over here and we'll go for a spin sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because you were what, riding a motorbike before that?
Yeah, I've never owned a car of my own. Like, obviously I can drive and I've driven my family car and my girlfriend's car and all that. But for me, just getting from A to B was always on the motorbike, which when I was 16 and, you know, I didn't have a lot of money at all. And I was like, oh, how do I get around on the cheap? And I was like, you know, motorbike, it's a really good solution. But then you think about, you know, lugging your helmet around and your jacket and your pants and all the gear, and then, you know, it's riding in the rain is just so annoying. So it's over time, like, I love riding motorbikes, but over time, using them to commute, while it's convenient in a way, it's also inconvenient in a way. So I kind of got a bit frustrated with that, but yeah, I've since upgraded.
Yeah, fair enough. That's cool. So those discounts pushed you over the edge, and that's been one of your like sort of long term financial goals as well, right?
To
own a Tesla, have that ticked off.
It was a hard thing to do because obviously the upfront cost is quite extreme versus some other cars. But I always keep thinking, you know, what if Elon pulls through and he does make this robo-taxi network? Could it actually turn out? Could this car turn out to make me money versus just depreciating? Because like Teslas, I think the current stats after 3 years of ownership, they depreciate about 10 to 15% of their value, which is substantially less than other things. So I'm like on the fence, and I hear some people that make this argument that, oh, you know, it's such a silly financial decision and blah, blah, blah. And then other people are saying, oh, no, I think that's quite smart. You know, the robo-taxi and whatever doesn't depreciate much. So I don't know. I think I just splurged a little bit and didn't really think about the financials of it too much. But
yeah,
I don't know. It would be pretty crazy if this car could actually end up making me money. I think that would be ridiculous.
Yeah, that's very cool. It's sort of like you can almost justify it like a Monish Prabhai free lottery ticket investment. Like, you were going to buy a car anyway,
so
might as well have some built-in robo-taxi upside.
I'll take that. It makes me feel better about my purchase.
Yeah, feel free to use that one. No, that's very cool, man. Look, so I mean, a lot of people that watch my YouTube channel or listen to this podcast are probably already familiar with you from the New Money and formerly Aussie Wealth Creation YouTube channel. I think I first came across you when you probably had around 5,000 subscribers. I think I've been watching
that's crazy
fairly early on, so it's been really, really cool to kind of see you explode, especially even just in the last couple of months. The YouTube channel seems to have taken off. Talk us through the journey of how you got into this whole space in the first place.
I've always been a big fan of watching YouTube channels. And back when I was doing my uni degree, I was studying to be a physio. I got really into learning about personal finance because at the time I kind of looked at what my options are for work once I get my physio degree. And I was like, man, physios don't actually make all that much money. I better, you know, do some other stuff as well, try and make some more money. And then you hear like stock market investing get floated around, and that kind of made me super interested in it. So long story short, you know, I started looking into it, and I started watching a whole bunch of different YouTube channels on personal finance and stock market investing. And I was like, all right, I got to do this. And then I started doing it. I called up my, you know, my uncle who's I think he deals in superannuation or something like that. And he's like, oh yeah, here's some advice just to get you started. And anyway, I didn't take his advice. I started buying all these individual companies thinking I was some investing god. And then I lost a whole bunch of money, which kind of humbled me a little bit, put me in my place, and made me wake up and realize actually there is a right and a wrong way to go about stock market investing. It's not just a money printing machine, this stock market. So I better actually learn how to do it. Learn how to do it properly. And so then I started, I basically took what I had learned and just turned them into my own YouTube videos, just saying, I think like one of the first or second videos on the channel is like, you know, what is an ETF or what is a listed investment company? Just like those diversified kind of investment companies. So then I never really expected anyone to watch. I just thought maybe one or two people might find the videos and potentially learn something from the mistakes that I had made. And then it just kind of kept growing. So I just kind of kept going, and you know, 4 years later, we are where we are.
Yeah, that's super cool. And it sounds like your uncle must have given you some reasonably good advice if you said you didn't listen and started buying individual companies. So is he pushing you towards the listed investment companies of the world and that sort of thing?
I think it's kind of the advice we'd give anyone that just comes up to us and is just like, oh, I want to get started in the stock market. What should I buy? And like, well, the thing you're probably going to say is, well, for you, you know, probably just go really widely diversified, track the market and leave it, because in 40 years, you'll probably make money. And if you do hold it for that sort of time, you'll be okay. So that's what he was saying to me. He was saying, look, you know, in Australia, we get these fully franked dividends. You can go wide diversification, listed investment companies. You get nice dividends, fully franked, starts that compounding effect, tax efficient. I was like, oh yeah, all right, cool. Sounds interesting. And then I just went out and at the time I was like listening to Motley Fool videos and reading their articles. And I was just like, oh, but the Motley Fool says I should buy this, 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 and this. All right, I'll do that instead. And then sure enough, you lose a whole bunch of money.
And you find out that the next week the Motley Fool says to sell it, and now you don't know what to do.
Exactly right. Exactly.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm starting to get that same sort of thing, and I'm sure you do as well. Like, I'll go to, you know, family Christmases or dinners or whatever, and people, you know, see that you're into the stock market and start telling you, you know, I bought shares in XYZ company that I've never heard of. And they're like, what do you think? How's this going to go?
That's the classic. I always cringe a little bit when like family members come up and say, oh, I read something in the paper and turns out that XYZ company shares are really cheap at the moment, so I decided to buy some. I was like, oh my gosh, what have you just fallen into? But that's all right. I try my hardest just to try and just recommend some basic diversification, long-term investing strategy. But yeah, who knows? I don't know. I think most people, in fact, most regular people probably just treat the stock market a little bit too much like a sports bet or something like that. Bet365, but you know, is what it is.
Yes. Speaking of sports betting, that was one of your first viral videos on YouTube, right?
Yeah, it was. What a segue. That was, segue game is on today, Tom.
Leveling up.
Yeah. Yeah, that was. That still to this day is my most viewed video, which is just ridiculous. I'm trying to navigate to it now because I don't even know where it's at the moment. But isn't it funny, you know, my content's just about the stock market, long-term investing, value investing, you know, Warren Buffett style. And then I just make this one video, which I thought was a kind of interesting story, because way back in the day, I used to do this arbitrage betting strategy, not on a big scale at all. Like I was a teenager, so I was only, so it didn't make, made me like a couple hundred dollars. Anyway, turns out that if you start making money too frequently on betting sites, they kick you off. Who would have thought? If you beat the house, they don't like you very much. But anyway, yeah. So I started doing that. I got banned from a website called Ladbrokes, and then I made a video about how that happened. And just out of nowhere, this is the my first experience in viral videos. It just started picking up in that YouTube algorithm like I couldn't believe. I was like, how is this possible? And that's when it really opened my eyes that, wow, YouTube, the algorithm is very powerful. And yeah, still to this day, it's my most viewed video, sitting at, where is it? At 1.3 million views, which is pretty insane for a channel that talks about the stock market.
Yeah, that's crazy. YouTube's a strange beast like that. Like I don't have a huge channel by any means, but I've had a couple videos do reasonably well. And those one or two videos that I, you know, uploaded well over a year ago at this point probably still account for like half of my monthly ad revenue off YouTube. It's unbelievable how that happens.
It is bizarre. It really is down to just a few key videos that really drag your channel along. I remember one of your really popular ones was the intrinsic value one, wasn't it?
So I basically did one video going through sort of Phil Town's like margin of safety calculator, Apple as an example, and that did really well. That fun
that's
fact,
like half,
actually,
almost half a million.
Yeah, fun fact, actually, that was my first ever video to hit 1,000 views on my entire YouTube channel.
Wow, that's awesome!
And that's still my top viewed video. And then basically, I sort of did an updated version of that where I went through like Monish Pabrai's method for calculating intrinsic value, and that's now my second most popular video.
Yeah. That's crazy. Well, I know what I'm making for content next week.
Yeah, absolutely. I know Hamish has done an intrinsic value one before as well, which I think's up there for him too. So,
well, I think they're smart videos because I think that's where most people, they just don't know what they're doing. You know, I feel like most people can understand where a competitive advantage might lie and maybe a network effect like Facebook, they understand, you know, look at the management and whatever, but then it's just like, well, how do I actually know what these shares are actually worth? Like, what should I be buying them for? That's really the secret sauce that everyone wants to know is like, if I buy Facebook at whatever, however much it is right now, is that good or is that not good? And I think people just like, I don't know, sure, why not? That's kind of their valuation process mostly. So it's good to actually, you know, learn those intrinsic value calculations, discounted cash flow, et cetera, to actually get a bit more context. So I think that's why they do really well. And you explain it really well. I've watched both of those videos and you explain it very well.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I still find some of those older videos a bit cringe when I'm still figuring out how to talk to a camera, but they're getting
always
better.
Yeah, always. I still feel a bit like that looking at my own content. Yeah. It's like, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever gone back and watched like some of your first uploads, but I've done that on my channel and I just cringe immediately at some of those older videos.
Yeah. I think it's good to leave them up though, because then it's just like, it shows you that progression. And when you talk to someone, you're like, oh, why not start a YouTube channel? Yes, you'll be crap at the start, but you get better over time. You know, look at my first videos and then I'm here and I'm just like looking at the ground and like, oh, I'm going to talk about the stock market versus like the growth over time. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And even with, I remember before I started YouTube, I'd go back and watch like some of Jeremy from Financial Education's oldest YouTube videos. And he's talking about like, what is a checking account and what is a savings account on the super wide angle GoPro?
Yeah.
You know, all this
stuff. That's how I started as well with the super wide angle GoPro. Yeah. It's pretty funny.
Yeah,
it looks terrible.
Yeah, I was front facing iPhone camera, I think.
Oh, nice. Well, and that would have been a step eventually up on upgraded. The GoPro.
Yeah, but a lot of the first videos I did, I was just carrying it around in my hand and it was real unsteady and everything. I didn't even have a tripod or have it sitting on anything.
But shaky, shaky.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things I was keen to get into, if you're happy to talk about it, like you've obviously blown up on YouTube over the past year or so, and it's been crazy to kind of watch your journey, but I'm interested to get in sort of the decision or how the transition process looked from you going from like full-time physio work into full-time YouTube. That was obviously a massive decision for you. So what did that process look like?
Yep. I think when I decided to leave physio and go full-time YouTube, I think I was making about between $30 and $80 a day on YouTube. So it was like that's every single day. So that was okay, but you know, a little bit risky at the same time. And no doubt it was difficult, but the way I saw it was, you know, YouTube is my own thing. It's my own business. Physio, I could have started my own physio business, but probably not for a little while because I wasn't experienced enough yet. So I was just working for someone else, as you do in you know, private practice, and I was earning my steady paycheck from fortnight to fortnight. But it wasn't really going anywhere. You know, wage growth, I think in Australia is like 3% annually, if that. So, you know, you just get this very slow kind of gradual build in your salary, as a lot of people experience. I was like, man, I don't really know if this is, you know, if this is me. I've got, you know, high hopes. I want to dream big and just really reach for the stars kind of thing. And then I see this YouTube channel, and in the early days, you know, I was getting a couple hundred views. And I think when I first started my physio job, I was getting maybe 100 views a video or something like that. And then, you know, a year after working physio, I was getting, you know, 1,000 views per video and so on. Then 2,000 views per video a year after that. And it got to this point where I was seeing the growth, where definitely my YouTube income wasn't as good as my physio income, but I could just zoom out and look at that long-term view, and I could see that growth trend in YouTube. And I was literally looking at the chart of, you know, revenue and views and subscribers going up and up and up by more and more and more every single month, whereas my physio was just basically linear, very slight growth over time, not really. So there was a kind of point where I plotted the two lines over each other and saw this exponential curve versus this kind of slowly growing linear curve. And I just went, you know what? While it doesn't make sense financially right now to just go all in on YouTube, if I go all in on YouTube and it does work, then in 6 months from now, it'll be the best decision I ever made. And I'm super fortunate that I decided to get into YouTube full time when I did, because I just went crazy. I just like made so many videos. I built Profitful in that time as well and launched that. And yeah, looking back now, I should have made that decision way, way earlier. But understandably, I didn't, because at the time, with all the information that's available to you, you're like, hell no, I'm not going to go full-time YouTube and I'm earning this amount every fortnight from physio. But yeah, when you can see that you're getting consistent views and you just think, you know, if I left now, I could make another video per week, another two videos per week, and just go for it, then yeah, that's kind of where I got to. And yeah, I'm just super, super lucky and thankful that it worked out, I guess. But that's kind of the story.
Yeah, that's super cool. And it's worked out probably better than you'd ever expected, or were you confident you could get it to where it is now?
Absolutely. Yep. I did not expect my YouTube channel to grow as much as it has with me being able to work on it full time. Like you could kind of say, oh, you can kind of expect that, you know, if you leave a full-time job and you're making an extra video a week and all your videos are in better, you know, better depth, better research, better quality, because you've got more time to put into them, then sure, it makes sense that, you know, it should be fantastic. You should be growing better and better and better, but I don't know. You don't really think about that, but yeah, I could never expect, you know, what's happened on YouTube. It's just ridiculous. And it's starting to happen to you as well. Like just over 22,000 subscribers. Like that'd be at 50,000, 100,000 in no time. I reckon it'll be, would you do YouTube full time if you could?
Well, this is why I'm asking you these questions, Brandon. I'm trying to figure it out.
Right. Look,
I think I'm at basically the point you just described now, where I'm earning like $30 to $60 a day, maybe ballpark, fairly consistently now. And like YouTube's obviously quite volatile, but over time you build up like a library of content that kind of continues to chug away. And I think I'm sort of at the point now where I've probably traded off putting out more videos for maybe slightly sacrificing like the quality of each individual video. And I feel like I could bump up that aspect of it. So
yeah,
I'm sort of trying to figure out where that threshold is that, you know, pushes you to just doing it full time.
Mm. Yeah. Like obviously that's something that you gotta make sure it works for you. And that's the other thing is that when I talk about starting your own business or running a YouTube channel, you hear some of these crazy stories where it's just like, I've got 100 subscribers, but YOLO, I'm going to go full-time YouTube. And it's like, whoa, no, what are you doing? Do not leave your job for a YouTube channel that has 100. But you're right. There's a certain moment in time where you're just like, right. I think the point for me was I sat back and I went, you know what? If I don't, like, I could see that slightly exponential curve ramping up. And I just thought to myself, if I don't chuck everything I've got at this YouTube channel, I'm going to regret. Like that's, I'm going to be sitting back as a 60-year-old physio and saying, man, I should have done that YouTube thing. I should have tried it. Because seeing everybody else's success and what you can achieve on the platform, I was like, man, I would be kicking myself if I didn't at least give it a crack. So that's kind of really, I got to that point. That was really the point where I was like, okay, I got to try. And I'm glad that I took the leap and never look back.
Yeah, very, very cool. And I feel like both of us are probably in a similar position where we're, you know, like mid-20s, we don't have kids or own a house or anything. It's sort of like the ideal time to take that kind of risk, right?
Exactly. You're talking yourself into it now, Tom. I like it. I like it.
Yeah. We shall see.
Yeah, it's going to be your next video next week. I quit my full-time job.
Yeah, definitely.
We shouldn't say, don't say that publicly. I mean, we like working in agriculture companies.
Yeah. 100%. Agriculture is actually a very cool industry to work on, just as an aside. Like there's a lot of interactive farmers are very cool people. Like a lot of people have this impression of farmers in their head that they're kind of just people that inherited the family farm and just do what their dad did. But a lot of those people are like really intelligent.
Oh yeah.
Businesswoman, basically. Yeah. Very cool industry to work on actually.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. So I enjoy it, but we may be reaching the tipping point soon. Who knows?
Yes. That's what I want to hear.
Great. I'll ponder that lots while I'm editing this podcast episode, I'm sure. And I think about it all the time anyway. So
that's good.
Now you've just G'd me up a bit.
Yes. Good. Good.
All right, cool. Before I send an email off to my boss or do something like that, let's change tack slightly.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Okay. I'm keen to talk investing because we have pretty similar investing strategies.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Have a lot of the same influences and that sort of thing. Give us, for anyone who maybe hasn't come across you before, you know, in a couple of minutes or however long it might take you, what is your sort of general investing strategy in a nutshell?
It is stay within, look at companies that I am generally interested in already that fit within what I would call my own circle of competence, then research the crap out of them so that I actually understand, because I have no form, like people think that I'm some economist or some finance dude. I have no formal training in stock market investing. I'm just someone that finds it interesting. So I don't have those kind of advantages that, you know, people that study economics and finance all have. So I'm just like, okay, find something that I kind of know a little bit about already. That's what I would say in my circle of competence, study the heck out of it so that I actually understand how this business works. And then after that, make sure that business has some form of competitive advantage, some form of moat, which I know that this is like probably exactly what you'd say to the viewers of your channel as well. Some sort of moat, something that keeps them ahead, something that shields their business from attackers that want some of their market share. After that, check the management team, make sure that their interests are aligned with the interests of long-term shareholders, make sure they're good people, make sure that they're actually effective, that they can reinvest well back into the business and grow the business. And I've got a track record of doing that. And then after that, make sure you value the shares so that you know that you're not paying through your teeth for the shares, which is like basically every company right now you're paying through your teeth for some of the shares. Make sure you only buy it at a discount to intrinsic value and take your margin of safety. And that's it.
That's the name of the game.
The 4M. 4M analysis. Phil Towns style. Warren Buffett style. Charlie Munger style. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did you get from Brandon, brand new to investing, got told to invest in listed investment companies, but sunk some money into Tesla or whatever. How did you get from that to where you are now with building this investing framework? How'd you learn all this stuff?
So I started out willy-nilly, buy whatever company, toss a coin and buy that company, just stupid stuff. Lost a whole lot of money. Not a whole lot, because I was very young. I didn't have very much money. But for me, it was a lot of money at the time. Then switched to, let's go ETF style, diversified, compounding for a very long period of time, my whole life, get that average market return, passive investing. And then I was like, if I want, let's learn how to invest properly. So to learn to invest properly, I should probably learn from the people that do know or that are very successful at investing. So naturally, everyone goes to Warren Buffett. And I start to learn about Warren Buffett stuff. And he's like, Warren Buffett recommends The Intelligent Investor. I open The Intelligent Investor, try and read it. And I'm like, what the hell is this? I do not. What is it like bond yield, blah, blah, something in stocks and bonds and what? And I didn't even get through the first section on bonds and I put it down. I was like, nope. And then I was still interested in learning about individual companies. So I thought that Warren Buffett was like way out of my league. I'm like, nope, I cannot understand what Warren Buffett does if he's like saying, read The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham. but anyway, I still started just reading other books and then I just came across Rule One by Phil Town. I was like, man, this guy actually explained Warren Buffett's strategy in a really simple to understand way that makes sense. And, he actually gives you those pointers. He doesn't say just like, make sure the company's got a moat. He's like, make sure it's got a moat. And this is how you assess whether this company has a moat. And the stuff he talks about makes sense. Some of it's like simplified a little bit, but, it makes sense. Make sure the company is growing at 10% per year in some of these key metrics. And that tells you that nothing's slowing it down. So that was really the tipping point when I read Rule One. And you come out of reading Rule One, you're just feeling like you're some stock market genius, which you're not. But then that really inspired me to read Monish Pabrai's book. I've read Guy Spier's book, Peter Lynch's book. And you kind of pick up on these recurring themes. Like all of those books talk about margin of safety. So I'm like, if I want to be a good investor, I should probably note down margin of safety. That's probably a pretty integral part of successful investing. You pick up on these familiar themes. And I think overall, just learning from all these investors that have done it really, really well is kind of what molds your own strategy, because you just pick up, definitely moats are important. Definitely management teams are important. Definitely margin of safety is important. And that kind of just over time has molded the strategy that I kind of follow. But you can tell, it's not an original strategy. you could look at the strategy that I follow and talk about and be like, so that's Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, Phil Town, Monish Pabrai, Peter Lynch, all merged into one, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, I find it kind of funny, actually. Sometimes I go back and read through the comment sections of Warren Buffett interviews, and there's people there saying he's been saying the same thing for 50 years, why doesn't he have any new advice? And you're like, because it still works,
because it's still the right advice.
Yeah, 100%.
People were saying broccoli's good for you 50 years ago because it's still good for you.
it's funny how some things never change. Like I don't know when the Intelligent Investor was written, but I don't know, the 20s or 30s.
The 30s.
And like you say, there's some pretty heavy stuff in there with going into the depths of different bonds and all sorts of different stuff. But a lot of the key, like if you read, I think it's chapter 9 and chapter 20, which is what, Mr. Market and margin of safety. Those things still apply today. And it's cool to see people like Phil Town put that into an easy to understand format.
Definitely. I think absolutely helps you out if you are someone that wants to get into investing, but is just brand new, never studied it, then yeah, it's very, very helpful.
Yeah, I think we have pretty much the same bookshelf by the sounds of it. So
yeah, I'm fully on board. I haven't read. I see Poor Charlie's Almanac in the back of your videos all the time. How long is that book? Is that like a fat thing? Because I've never read it.
Yeah, and I haven't read all of it because it's not really a book that you sort of sit down and read like cover to cover. Oh, okay. It's like a coffee table kind of book where it has lots of short, like maybe lectures he's given or some article he wrote or some story about his life that someone tells. Like it's very much you'll read 4 or 5 pages at a time kind of thing.
I see. Yeah.
But it's very good though. I think it came out probably in the 90s and
okay.
He was asked at the Daily Journal meeting a couple of weeks ago, you know, would you make any changes to Poor Charlie's Almanac today? And he was like, nah, still have all the same ideas. So,
I've said what I have to say.
it is really good. I think it's quite expensive. That was actually a gift, so I don't know how much it costs or anything. But it's a cool kind of like big grunty book to just sit on a shelf in the videos as well. So
looks like it's $140 or something like that.
Yeah, that's probably right.
It's a big, beefy coffee table book. Yeah,
I think you get it off Amazon, and you've also got to be careful not to buy the version that's written in Mandarin or something as well. So that's funny. Buyer beware.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I can see that one right here. publisher, Shang Yi Zhu Khan. probably not that one.
Yeah, if I could speak that language, maybe I'd give it a go, but that's not going to work for me too well right now.
No, me neither.
Cool. So how'd you go from, I guess, reading, because I came out to the other end of reading Phil Town exactly like you, feeling like a superstar, but how do you go about trying to apply that to some companies in real life in real time? What's that process?
It was hard. Because a lot of the stuff that Phil Town points you to in the books, like some of the resources, you just can't access anymore. They just don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Some of them do, some of them don't. So it was still quite difficult. And there was a period of time, even after reading that book, where I'd tried a little bit and then get demoralized because I couldn't find this bit of information. But I think just continuing reading these other books and getting more familiar with how company reports are laid out and where the numbers are, you know, doing a lot of, like at the time, because I've got no background in this, I didn't know how to read an income statement or a balance sheet or a cash flow statement. I didn't really understand any of those numbers. And Phil Town's book is very much like you find this number here on the cash flow statement, but I still didn't understand like what the cash flow statement even told you. So I think at that point then, I said, okay, I still need a deeper understanding. I still need to try and learn more. So I tried to, you know, watch a lot of YouTube videos on, you know, what to look for in a company financial statements, blah, 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 and just go a little bit deeper. And then I actually feel like once I felt much better after I had that solid basic understanding of the financial statements. Like I'm definitely no god when it comes to like picking out data and different ratios and blah, blah, blah out of all those financial statements. But I felt much, much better after I took the time to learn about those three key financial statements. I think that was big for me because then that really picks up your confidence because it's like a second language, really, the stuff that they talk about, like purchase of property, plant and equipment. It's like, yeah, it kind of makes sense, but at the same time, it's like, well, what does that actually include? Or it's like cash flow from investing activities or, you know, what's the difference between operating income and net income and that sort of thing. It's like, what? I don't quite. So I think that's actually taking the time to understand that was very beneficial. And that made me a little bit more confident in doing deeper analysis, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. And as odd as this may sound, there's actually a very good video on YouTube that, who was it? I think Bill Ackman did. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but Bill Ackman did a video. It's called something like Everything You Need to Know About Investing in 60 Minutes or something. And
I get that recommended to me all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. He basically goes through and he gives this example of a business, which I think he uses like a lemonade stand. And he talks through how economics of the lemonade stand work and how that would be represented in all the different financial statements. And they talk about, oh, yep, they bought a new blender, so this is purchase of, you know, property, plant, yeah, equipment and so on, and how that impacts cash flow and all this sort of stuff. So that was actually really useful to try and get your head around how practically, like, what these numbers mean in real life in a real business.
Good resource. Yeah, yeah. I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, my little scroll bar of how much you've watched has gotten me up to about 5 minutes. I can see I've watched about 5 minutes of this video once, but I have not made it through to the end. I should sit down. 43 minutes, that's not too bad.
Yeah, you've got to commit to that one.
Yeah. It's like Ray Dalio's video. I forgot how the economic machine works. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a really good video. But yeah, you have to sit down for like half an hour, 40 minutes to watch it.
Yeah, that's more of a macro
that one
type
taught
one.
Me a lot. Yeah, that one taught me a lot as well. Because that's once I started understanding a little bit more about how to look at individual companies, then you start hearing all of the macro terminology. And I'm like, man, I don't understand any of this macro stuff. Like, people are talking about interest rates and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, gee, I don't know. So that was when I started to try and look at macro stuff a little bit more. And Ray Dalio is just the macro investing god, isn't he?
Yeah. So do you apply much of your opinions on macro stuff in your own individual investing, or is it just something that interests you?
No, I'm not particularly interested in the macro, to be honest. I just started hearing this stuff enough. And I think it happened, like, especially with what's been happening recently, it's important to know, because you've got like reserve banks, which are printing a lot of money and interest rates are at record lows. And it's just good to have that understanding. Like, you don't really think about it too much. You're still looking for individual businesses, which are, you know, have competitive advantages and are making good cash flows. And, you know, you're looking at, for investing, I feel like, well, for the investing we do, you're looking at the individual company, but it's still good to have, I guess, an understanding of this broader macro stuff, just so you know what's kind of happening in the global economy, the global, I don't know what you'd say, financial system, I suppose, what the trends are, like what I was saying before with central banks printing money and interest rates at record lows and whatnot, and what sort of impact that has. But yeah, Ray Dalio is a gem to learn from when it comes to macro. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. I'm definitely on team micro over macro. Like, it, you know, if something happens to Google or something, like, which is a business probably both of us understand pretty well.
Yeah.
If something happens to Google and it's suddenly at like a 60% margin of safety, but the market's at all time highs and, you know, interest rates are doing something weird, that's not going to stop us probably from buying Google, right?
No way. Nah.
Yeah. There's a guy I follow. I'm not sure if you would have heard of him, called Jake Taylor. He's on.
Oh, no.
He's on a podcast by Toby Carlyle, who runs like the Acquirers Funds and Acquirers Multiple. They do a podcast each week called Value After Hours.
Okay.
And one of the things that Jake sort of describes, like, researching macroeconomic stuff is kind of like eating dessert. Like, a little bit of it is kind of good every now and then, but you don't want to gorge yourself on macro stuff, because that's probably going to deteriorate from your overall investment results.
Makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So how strict are you on some of this sort of Philtown stuff? Like, you know, he lays out these rules about a company must grow at 10% a year with these various metrics, and we only buy at a 50% margin of safety and so on. Have you been fairly strict with trying to implement that?
Well, I started really strict, and then what I soon learned is that there's always going to be something about a company that doesn't fit. There's always going to be maybe, because I mean, some of his rules are insanely strict. It's like over the 3 year and the 5 year and the 10 year and the 1 year, you have to see growth in EPS and revenue and equity and free cash flow. You have to see them all over 10%. But, you know, there might be a company specific event which, you know, they're going to get over in 2 years, which has caused their free cash flow or their revenues to drop by 5% this year or something like that. And that company can still be fantastic, and you can see a clear road for them to get back to where they were before. I mean, I guess 2020 was a prime example of even great companies that have big fat moats, because of this market-wide global economy event that we saw, they still struggled for like the year. And so a lot of those companies would have had something about their numbers which Phil Town's book would have said, no, you say no to those companies. Whereas they can still be really, really good companies. So I think initially I was like, okay, we've got to follow this super strict. You know, if it doesn't hit the metrics, then just chuck it out, you know, save it for another day, come back later. But the more that you look into companies, the more you realize that there's never a perfect company. There's nothing that's just like absolutely in the slot. And I think if there's a company that is absolutely in the slot, then it's basically impossible to get it at a fair price. Yeah. It's like if there's a company that's like, oh yeah. I mean, you can think about a company like Google where everybody looks at the balance sheet of Google and it's just like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. And they've got this big fat moat and they've got so much power and the return on invested capital is fantastic. They're just hitting it out of the park. But because of that, it's really expensive.
Yeah.
So I think now it's just the way I see it now is you want there to be a moat and you want it to be proven in numbers and you want the management team to return a good return on investor capital. You want all these things. You want to make sure definitely that you can get it at some sort of discount to intrinsic value. But the way I see it is it's more about, okay, if there's things that don't quite fit, you have to understand why they don't fit and whether that's going to be a long-term issue. Because if revenue goes down by 5% because, I don't know, like the global pandemic, well, global pandemic's not going to last forever. They can bounce back from that. But if they went down 5% because, you know, their mine blew up or something like that, then you're like, oh, okay, that's problematic. Yeah. So I think it's more about just like understanding why things are happening and understanding whether that's going to impair the company long-term or short-term and making your decisions accordingly, I suppose.
Yeah.
Does that make sense, I guess?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's very much events-based investing, right? Like,
yeah.
like you say, if you find the perfect company, it's probably not going to trade at a fair price or at a margin of safety price unless something dramatic happens, which will in turn show up and make that company not perfect, like in the eyes of Phil Town, right?
So, catch 22. Yeah,
absolutely. But like you say, it's about understanding the business and trying to figure out, is this going to be a short-term event, which means the company gets back to hitting all these really good growth rates we're looking for? Or is it going to be something that is more of a long-term problem? Like, you know, you're looking at Blockbuster and Netflix just came out with a streaming service, right? So you've got to distinguish between the two.
Isn't there some story like the original Blockbuster store, or that there's still like the last Blockbuster store is still open or something like that?
Yeah, I think
that's just some crap that I've made up.
No, there's a YouTube video on it. They went and interviewed the guy that owns the last Blockbuster store.
Wow, yeah. Good on him, man. That's I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, he's holding out hope for a comeback in DVDs, is he? What's going on?
That'd be a collector's item. Collector's item. Yeah, right. Well, you have to wait for about 50 years before they are.
Yeah, and even then you might be in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. Nah.
Yeah. Didn't Netflix try to sell to Blockbuster at one point?
I got no idea. I'm not sure. Potentially.
Yeah. I might have to fact check that, but I'm pretty sure Blockbuster had the opportunity to buy Netflix before they did streaming, because Netflix used to like send out DVDs in the post, right?
Yeah.
That was their original business, I think. So who knows? Maybe if they bought Netflix, then they wouldn't have ever done the streaming service anyway and it wouldn't be like today. I don't know.
Imagine, because, Netflix and Blockbuster were, back in the day, like similar-ish businesses. It's just Netflix would send you stuff in the post. Imagine if Blockbuster came up with the Netflix streaming service idea, and instead we all just had Blockbuster subscriptions on our smart TVs. It's funny sometimes how things end up.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like we could be tuning into Blockbuster right now instead of tuning into Netflix. It's just that Netflix got there. They had the idea.
Yeah, it's funny how things played out. I often think of a business like Disney. It's kind of amazing how Disney's been around for so long, because they've always had lots of different business segments and they've been able to sort of shift towards things that are doing well and away from things that are doing poorly. Like, they didn't get stuck going 100% into selling all their movies on DVDs. They also had theme parks and, you know, were constantly producing new content and that sort of stuff as well.
It is smart. It does make it harder to track those sort of businesses and harder to understand them. But from a business perspective, obviously, it totally makes sense having diversified revenue streams. And you're right, Disney is one of those perfect examples where, you know, if they had been 100% in studio entertainment, then last year they would have gotten absolutely destroyed. I mean, they still did suffer a bit, but because they've got, well, this is not really the best example now because all their theme parks were closed as well, but they have the studio entertainment, they have the theme parks, then they have the, you know, all the various royalty commission deals, merchandise, blah, 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 whatever. They've got all those brands. They've got, you know, Disney Plus. They've got all these different streams of income. So it's just like, okay, well, if one struggles, then, you know, we can transition towards another one. And it also gives them a huge advantage because it's just like they can undercut Netflix on a streaming service now because they have money coming in from other areas of their business. So it's kind of helpful to gain, you know, a better competitive position as well, which is interesting. That's what I find interesting about Disney.
Yeah. Are you a Disney Plus subscriber?
Yeah, I've got Disney Plus. I'm a big Star Wars fan, so I'm mainly in it Wars content. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I was a really big star. My trust in Disney's Star Wars has been shaken, but The Mandalorian's all right, so I watch that. But my girlfriend loves a lot of those old nostalgic Disney movies as well. I mean, I do too.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Lion King recreation was incredible.
Yeah, that was bizarre. Yeah. It's so funny, though. It's like the Lion King recreation, they could never win with that because they decided to keep it basically exactly the same. Like exactly the same story. So everyone was just like, oh, this is so, you know, why you just kept it exactly the same? This is so unoriginal. But then if they'd changed it and done something different with the story, then everyone would have been like, how can you change the Lion King? It's like a lose-lose situation. But it did look pretty spectacular. That technology is just ridiculous these days. It looks so lifelike.
Yeah, it looked cool. And from a business perspective, they're sort of like setting up the next generation for in 30 years' time, they can do another Lion King recreation.
It's kind of funny. We can save money on the script writing department. They've been doing that with all their old nostalgic movies, just making modern day versions. It's like, yeah, we'll just save money. We don't need script writers for the next year. We're just going to remake Mulan and remake Aladdin, remake the Lion King.
Yeah, it's funny. Oh, it's funny.
Seems to be working.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens. Like, I remember when the movie A Star Is Born came out a couple of years ago with like Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. I never realized that A Star Was Born had already been a movie like 20, 30 years ago or something.
There you go. I learned something new then.
So we're like the kids that are watching Lion King today that never realized there was a previous Lion King.
What are you talking about? What is this 1994 motion picture, The Lion King? Is that related?
Yeah, 100%.
It's funny.
Yeah. If you don't mind me asking, are you a Disney shareholder?
I was. I'm not anymore. Mm-hmm. I just got to a point where I just thought it was too overvalued, so I sold it. But I don't blame people for being Disney shareholders.
Yeah.
It sits right in my slot. I mean, it's regarding stuff that I really find quite exciting, you know, theme parks, movies, TV shows, that sort of stuff. So,
yeah,
it's in my slot. But yeah, I think I think I bought it in like March last year or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then it got quite pricey for where I wanted it to be. So I decided to sell it. But hindsight, what a terrible decision. I think it's continued to rocket.
Yeah, but it's just
$194
like,
US dollars a share. Oh, ouch. Should have held it.
It's just a sign of the times, though. I feel like everyone's biggest mistake at the moment is selling, which is kind of a scary thought that that's everyone's biggest mistake. It? So,
yeah, taking profits is our biggest mistake.
Yeah. How do you think about sort of managing the overall portfolio, like making those types of decisions to sell versus continue holding, like Charlie Munger style, if it's a little bit expensive versus shifting into new companies or that sort of thing?
Well, I think Charlie Munger talked about that in his recent Daily Journal thing, didn't he? He's like, when do you go about selling a stock? And he said, I don't really have a great framework for that. And to be honest, I don't really have a good framework for it either because, you know, there are, for example, like I bought Tesla back in 2017 and it's the return on that has been ridiculous. Any value investor would have sold it a long, long time ago, but somehow I still hold it. And I've kind of made that commitment to myself that if the company is still doing all right, I don't care about the valuation. I do want to hold this for like 40 years just to see, because I think the Tesla can become something ridiculous in, 40 years. But then there are other companies like Disney where I'm like, oh, this is, getting a bit rich. And I decided to sell it. So I don't even know if I have a good framework for that. It's probably something I should work on, to be honest. And do you have a good framework for deciding, when to hold, when to sell? I guess generally I would imagine you'd be in the camp of, generally speaking, you'd want to hold a good business even if it's gone a bit expensive. Is that right, or you think differently? Or?
Yeah, depends, which seems to be the answer to a lot of these things. Depends. Like I invest in the sort of Philtown-ish type businesses, for lack of a better word, but I'm probably a little bit more open than you to perhaps invested in like the Cigar Butts of the world and like the really cheap kind of businesses. So it depends. Like if I have one of these Cigar Butt type companies, if it gets to intrinsic value, it's just sold straight away, like no brainer kind of decision.
Right. Okay.
Whereas if I have one of these good businesses, long-term compounders, that's a more challenging decision. And then it comes down to, have I already got half my portfolio in cash, in which case I'm probably just going to keep holding it. I don't want to be even more in cash. Versus, am I fully invested possibly, and I've just found this other company that looks really attractive and is at a big margin of safety, then I'm probably going to sell it. So it just depends on the type of investment and then what the overall sort of portfolio is doing as well.
That's a good point, actually, is thinking about, well, if I sell it, where is the money going? Because I feel like, I don't know about you, but I really haven't found very many buying opportunities for a very long time. So I'm just like accumulating cash, which is just like, oh, this is so like so annoying, because in the long run, cash is trash and you don't really want to hold cash.
What a problem to have, Brandon.
I know. Like it's bizarre, but you do. I mean, you still go to work, you still earn your money, and people like us that are really into stock market investing, we want to put that money into the stock market because we care about compounding and building our wealth over time. And, investing in these great businesses, but we're running into the problem that everything's so expensive. So I think you raise a good point. It's if you're thinking about selling, thinking about, okay, if I sell this business that I believe in for the long term, what am I then going to do with that money? Do I have that next opportunity to, that undervalued business that I want to get into, or is it just going to add to my cash pile? I mean, sometimes I guess the company would be so expensive that you're just like, well, let's just ensure I take my profits. And then if it sits in cash, then whatever, it's better than potentially going and losing half of its value in the next couple of months because the company was so expensive. But yeah, I think that's something interesting to think about. But yeah, I like what Charlie Munger said in that recent Daily Journal meeting, where it was just like, he's got a friend where if it goes really expensive, he sells half of his position. So then either way, he can't be wrong. If it goes down, then he sold half of it. If it keeps going up, then that's all right, because he's still half in.
Yeah.
I think Charlie Munger says he doesn't follow that strategy himself, but he doesn't condone it either.
I think, let me know if I've got the wrong end of the stick here, but I feel like you might have said that on your podcast, on the Young Investors podcast, you did something like that with Tesla.
Oh, I did that with Tesla. Yeah, I did that a long time ago, actually. So in hindsight, another terrible decision to sell. because this is way back in the day. I bought it like $250 before its, 5-to-1 split and whatever. Yeah. And then I think it had gone up to like $400, $450. And at that point, I was like, whoa, it's never been in this territory before. Tesla is still really struggling to build the Model 3 and to generate a profit. I think it's never been this high before, and it seems like it really shouldn't be this high. I'll just clear my original stake off the table, so I can't lose. I might lose my profits, but I can't actually lose money on this investment. So that's what I did. In hindsight, terrible decision. Should have held it.
Yeah, and it's that other half that you sort of just plan to hold forever, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It's just like, well, I'm playing with house money now, and I do believe in the company. Like, yes, it's so volatile. It could go up or down 10% in a day, and you've got no idea which way it's going.
Yeah.
But I think that with the rate of growth they're achieving with Elon Musk at the helm and the plans that they have, the long-term plans, not even the next few years, but I'm thinking like 10, 20, 30 years, then I see it being a very integral company to the global economy. So I'm kind of, this is kind of one where I'm just like, you know what, just stick with it. You know, I'm just going to hold it no matter what. Cause I guess I can't lose. And I do believe, I really believe in the company. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting concept, managing an investment like that. Like part of me feels like that makes a lot of sense. You can't lose money on the investment. And the other part of me sort of says, that kind of seems like a little lazy and you're not treating every dollar with the respect it deserves kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So no, I understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. That's I'm just conscious of time. I don't want to take up too much of your day here, but I think maybe we
How
might...
long do you normally push the podcast episode? Do they usually go for about an hour, do they?
That's something that I've been extremely inconsistent with in my first few episodes.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I think I aim for roughly an hour usually. So
Okay.
I see we're coming up 50 odd minutes here. So I wonder if we rotate into some Q&A, maybe I put up a community post on YouTube just yesterday saying you were coming on and to get some questions. So
hopefully I can add some value.
Yeah, we'll find out.
We will.
Let me ask you one. So we've got a question from Nicholas Thompson saying, thoughts on active investing versus passive investing. Do you think that most retail investors are capable of getting an edge in stock picking?
I think definitely most retail investors are capable of getting an edge. And we're playing a very different game to people that are investing, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. Because we're nimble, we're agile, we move in, we can get in quick, we can get out quick, we can take our profits whenever we want. There's definitely advantages to being a small retail investor buying individual stocks. With that being said, and I think anyone can learn to do it, but I think it's mostly temperament. If you can train yourself to get the right temperament, then you'll do very well active investing. If you're someone that really struggles with the temperament needed to make good investments, then I think just go with passive investing. Passive investing, I think for most people is the right way to go. And I think Warren Buffett has said that many, many times before. For most people, like he doesn't do it himself, but for most people out there, just go passive investing. Trust in, you know, an established market that's proven, you know, 7-8% returns per year. I don't know what New Zealand's like, but Australia I think is like 10%. The S&P 500 is like 7 or 8%. So just, it's almost like as a passive investor, as a regular old person that wants to just invest in the stock market, but doesn't really want to, you know, research individual companies, your ignorance to what's going on in the stock market is your superpower kind of thing. You just find, you know, the strategy works. You keep showing up every year and you just keep buying. You're only in buy mode. You just keep buying, buying, buying. And you do that every single year for year after year after year, for decade after decade. And then you just enjoy the long-term average return of the market. Sure, in the first like 1 or 2 years, who knows what would happen? You might be up, you might be down. You could have invested in 2007 and think you're going great. And then 2008 and you're crying. But if you had kept investing, you know, 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012, then sitting here now, you would be very, very wealthy in 2021. So I think for most people, probably passive investing is the way to go because you don't have to think about it and it does work. But I definitely don't discourage people from being active investors. It's just that you got to have that temperament. That's my opinion anyway. What do you think?
Yeah, completely agree. I think if you're one of those people that's like posting in Facebook groups and stuff saying, what do you think of XYZ stock? What's it going to do this week? Probably passive investing is the way to go. But if you're someone, and passive investing works, like I love active investing and looking at individual companies, but like passive investing works. There's no, like I have no qualms about people going down that track and just doing other things with their time, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
I mean, if you don't care about businesses, if you don't care about studying companies, then like, don't waste your day. If you want to go, you know, wakeboarding, then go do that. Just be a passive investor.
Yeah, 100%. And I think if you're, so if you want to be a passive investor, it works. Just do that. If you want to be an active investor, I think you have to, number one, have the temperament, like you said, and number two, be able to understand and value a handful of businesses. And if you're someone that can value companies and you're someone that can look at your portfolio in the morning and see that, wow, it just got hammered and it's down 10% and get excited rather than sad about that, yeah, then you're probably someone that's in the right sort of frame of mind to be an active investor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right. Next question. This one's a bit more of a personal one, if you don't mind. This is, what do your family and friends think about you investing? Do they support you or do they scare you or scare you off investing?
No, they're generally pretty supportive. Like stock market investing, I think everybody knows that there's a right way and a wrong way to go about stock market investing. So sometimes people can be like speculators and then people might get a little bit worried, like, oh, should you be investing in stocks? But, you know, I think my family understand that, you know, the way I go about it is, you know, not a gambling kind of way. It's not like I'm a gambler in the stock market or anything. So they're generally supportive. And I try and get them into it as well. I try and get my friends into investing and that sort of thing. I think where there was a bit more, they're always supportive, but it was more the decision to do like YouTube full time. That was the one where I had more of a split where some people were saying, oh yeah, you know, good luck, do it. Yeah, go for it, you know, chase it. And then other people were like, oh, I don't know, you're a physio, it's a good job. Yeah, there's always demand for physios, stable income, maybe you shouldn't do that. So I think that generally speaking, most people have been supportive with investing, but there was a little bit more mixed reaction to the idea of actually going and making content about investing as for a living, I suppose. But yeah.
Yeah. And were those people that just don't understand how YouTube works, or they do understand it but aren't a fan of like the volatility or how much it would need to grow to make sense?
Yeah. I think there's a bit of that. I mean, I think a lot of people just, you know, most people just work a job and don't run their own business, and just that's all they know. They just know you work for someone else and every fortnight you get your money. So I think a lot of people that are in that mindset and have been in that mindset for their whole lives gave me that advice. You know, it's kind of from their perspective. It's like, this is what I've done and it's worked. I've worked for someone else for 40 years and I've gotten, you know, $1,800 a fortnight for, you know, for 40 years, do that because that's what's worked for me. But then, yeah, I think when it comes to taking advice from people in life, I think that you should definitely hear everybody out, but I think you should weigh people, you should value the opinion of people that have actually done what you're trying to do much more than people that have never done anything that you're trying to do. So if say you had been a YouTuber for 5 years and I was thinking about doing it full time, I would definitely weigh your opinion on whether I should be a YouTuber much more than, like, you know, my friend from school that works as a tradie now, kind of thing. I really do believe in that, because I feel like you'll get a lot of, you won't get the right kind of advice if you just ask, if you just value each person's opinion equally on what you should do. I definitely think you should weigh it towards listening to people that have actually done what you're trying to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely agree. Cool. Let's grab one more question. From Warren and Charlie, who, and someone's trying to call me. Let's deny that person.
Okay. Hello.
Oh, God, hang on.
Yes, boss. No, I'm hard at work.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God. All right, here we go. Aside from Warren and Charlie, who was it that inspired both of you to become value investors, and what information/teaching did you find most useful from them? If there's more than one, I'd love to hear the reasons for each. So you've probably touched on Phil Town, I suppose, already a bit, but anyone else you'd add to that list?
Phil Town really got me into it. I really enjoyed reading Peter Lynch's book and I like the way he goes about it. It's not really the same as, like, there's similarities, but it's not like the same as Warren Buffett or Phil Town's approach. But there's so many like hidden gems of how to make money in the stock market in his book. And I really like watching his interviews. I really respect the way he goes, I don't even know if he does still. I imagine he's still an investor, but he doesn't do anything active and he's pretty old. But I respect the way he goes about it. So Peter Lynch would be one of the ones I learned from for me. Phil Town, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger. Monish Pabrai. You probably follow Monish Pabrai closer than I do from looking at the content that you make. Do you want to talk about Monish?
Yeah, Monish Pabrai is top of my list after Phil Town and Warren and Charlie, I would say. I've read the Down to Investor twice now, and it just made like a stupid amount of sense to me. Like it was crystal clear. Yeah, and like
so good,
easy book to read, and that's probably why I've lent towards maybe some of the lower quality businesses, maybe a bit more than you have, right, would be that Monish Pabrai influence. Like when he talks about, you know, investing in, what was it? Frontline, the like oil tanker, ships. Geez, that's not a very good way of describing that business. But basically he talks through this business that is, or like this framework which explains the difference between risk and uncertainty. And that made a lot of sense to me. Like, probably a better example is a company like IPSCO. And I think I might have even mentioned this when I was on your podcast last year, but IPSCO is like a steel company that is in a very cyclical industry. Like, you have no idea what the profitability is going to be next year or the year after, or the year after that. You can't predict it. So it's very high uncertainty. But from an investment perspective, it was actually very low risk, because at that time, IPSCO had basically pre-sold all their tubular steel for the next 3 years. They knew exactly what they were going to earn in the next 3 years.
Right.
And you could buy the company at like 2x earnings. So you were going to get your money back and a bit more. And whatever happens in year 4, 5, 6, it's meaningless, really. It's because you've already got your money back in those first 2 years. So understanding that like difference between risk and uncertainty is something that just resonated with me. So Monish would definitely be up there.
Mm, yeah, no, I agree. No, that's a good lesson too about risk and uncertainty.
Yeah, I think it's an easy one to confuse. A lot of people see it as the same thing, or they say risk as just volatility. Like, Phil Town sometimes talks about this concept of beta, you know, just how volatile a stock is. A lot of the academics would call that risk, whereas he looks at what's the price of the company relative to its value as risk, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So just having that framework. I suppose in a lot of cases, you kind of want uncertainty in a way, because that can bring a lot of companies down to where they need to be. I mean, a company where there's every investor, including the big dogs, just think it's, you know, there's no uncertainty around anything, then it's just not going to come down to being cheap at all, kind of thing. So,
And you can apply that to like the Phil Town framework as well. Like, if you're buying a company that you think is going to grow at 20% a year for the next decade, but it's priced at a point where it only needs to grow 10% to give you a good return, and there's a lot of uncertainty about whether it's 10% or 20%, doesn't really matter, because 10% is still going to give you a good return. And if it grows 20, it's even better, right?
So it's low risk.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, makes sense.
Great. Well, let's wrap it up there for the questions. Thank you heaps for coming on, Brandon. I always enjoy talking to you, so I appreciate you taking the time. I know even though you're just YouTube full-time now, I know you're a busy man, so thanks for making the time.
Nah, it's all good. No worries. I enjoyed it. It's always good to have a chat with you, mate, and it's good. I like that you're starting up your own podcast too, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's been interesting trying to figure out all the technical stuff and how you actually put a podcast on 5 different platforms and do all of that, but figuring it out.
Podcasting, though. Podcasting's nice because it's just like unscripted. It's just sit down and have a chat, and, you know, it's very authentic. It flows very well. So I like it. And I'm honored for you to have me on the podcast. So I appreciate it too. Thanks for reaching out.
No, thanks for coming on, mate. And just for the 0.01% of the audience who somehow follows me and not you, where can people go to hear more from you?
Just on YouTube at New Money. You can check out, I run a business called Profitful if you're interested. But yeah, New Money is where you find my content. And that's Instagram, New Money Official, new.money.official. But that's pretty much, I'm just YouTube, Instagram. And then running the business as well. But that's
and where you, can you find might me. As well I think plug I, the podcast while you're at it.
Oh, of course, the podcast. How can can't I forget? Young that. Investors Podcast. Yeah. Have we done one or two episodes with you? I can't remember.
We've done just one. We did one last year, but
One last year. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I should have looked up what number that is. So for people's reference, I wonder if I can real quick. Anyway. But yeah, Young Investors Podcast, you can just find that wherever podcasts are, Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or whatever. And look for the one with Tom, but I can't find it. So I don't even know what number
just,
it is.
Just sucks. Search Investing with Tom, Young Investors Podcast or something. Google will throw it at you. You'll find it.
Yeah.
No,
Tom.
Yeah, you managed to track.
I'm trying to find it, but I can't find it.
Okay, don't worry about it. The people that really want it will find it.
They will find it. Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. Cool. Thanks heaps for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks, mate.
Cheers.